So democracy. They wanted to quash democracy. Why? Weren't they all about democracy? What were they about? Power, money. They had a lot of speculation in Western lands. They wanted the gold standard. They wanted to make a killing, literally and figuratively, off of the investments that they'd made in the war. They wanted to protect their property. And they got together and they did just that. One historian called the Constitutional Convention the first NAFTA because it was a meeting of the wealthiest people in the country in secret to standardize trade across borders for the consolidation of wealth for economic elites. And I'm not here to burst all your democracy balloons. That's not like my favorite hobby. I'm here because we have to tell an honest story about this so that we can know how to react to our history and how to create our future. And so when this Constitution was written, and it came out to be ratified by all the regular people who wanted an end to foreclosures and an end to debt and all these other things, what did these regular people think about the Constitution? Did they like it?
They wanted the Bill of Rights.
So this is extremely important. They demanded that one thing happen before they ratified it, that something be added to the Constitution. We just heard it up here. Anybody else know? The Bill of Rights. When I was younger, I thought, man, what sloppy people. They just didn't get around to it, and they had to add on stuff at the end? Come on, you guys. You get a C. But really, the Bill of Rights came out of a robust people's movement that was fighting these merchants who had fought against the king. They had fought against tyranny far away, but they didn't mind so much assuming power in their own home, their own country. And these regular people were fighting that and saying, no, I did not fight a revolution to get a property document. I fought for my political and economic sovereignty. And so you better pass a Bill of Rights or I'm not going to ratify that. And so those were their demands. And so when I say that, because when I talk about what it means to be an American, I don't often say that phrase because there are a lot of things to not be proud of. But when I talk about things I am proud of to be an American, I'm actually talking about mostly the Bill of Rights. Not as much the Constitution. What kind of things am I talking about? We listened to them before. Freedom of what?
Speech,
religion, press, assembly. Freedom from search and seizure, right? I'm talking about basic political protections. And those things were brought to us by a robust people's movement that fought against concentrated wealth at the formation of this country for their basic economic and political sovereignty. So there's that tradition still, that tension always between concentrated wealth and corporate capital and democracy. And the people fought for that. And let's ask ourselves one more question before we move on to how corporations actually got personhood. And this will help us move into that conversation. What three words start the Constitution of the United States?
We the people.
So that's a pretty poetic phrase. And there's a pretty poetic paragraph that comes after it. But technically, if a lawyer had gotten a hold of that, he would have been like, actually, it's we the legal persons, right? It's we the legal persons. Because what do legal persons get in a democracy?
Standing.
What do you mean by that? Recognition as a legal being, and you said the word rights a lot. A legal person gets access to rights enumerated in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They also get cultural legitimacy that comes from being considered a legal person. So can somebody tell me in this great democratic moment, or what is sold to us as this great democratic moment in our history, the writing of the Constitution, what percentage of the population qualified for the protections of legal persons? So I heard 1%. You said 1? 8? 10? What? Okay, so we have a lot of pretty accurate guesses here. Let's make a list first before we answer, before we reveal. Who did it not include?
Women.
Who else?
Slaves.
Okay, African people?
Non-property owners.
Indigenous people?
Irish people.
Irish people? Basically, a lot of people that the state didn't like or that were threatening to the state. So the answer is about 5 to 8% of the population actually qualified for protections of we the people. 5 to 8% people. So in the Occupy movement, we talk about being the 99%. These are the original 95% of people who did not count. And what do you think they thought of that? Were they fine with it? And the historian Molly Ivins, the writer, has said that the history of this country can be viewed as the history of all the people who didn't count the first time around, forming social movements to drive themselves into the phrase, we the people. So again, there's that tension. And once again, the history of this country that I'm proud of is the history of all those people who refused to accept that they weren't people and who said, no, being a person is a sacred thing to be, and having rights is non-negotiable, and we will form social movements to drive ourselves into the law and change the culture so that we're recognized as persons. So that is an extremely, I can't even emphasize enough the importance of that tradition in our country, and that's going to be really important when we talk in just a minute about why corporations wanted to be people, why they wanted in on that tradition. So we talked about protections from political tyranny, but we started the story by asserting that, or I asserted to you, that all power is both political and economic. So what did people in the early revolutionary period do to protect themselves from economic tyranny after the Constitution was written? They got rid of the king, they had the Bill of Rights, and they said, well, that's not enough, because what if British East India Company comes back and starts bossing us around? What are we going to do about that? So they got together and they created some basic people's laws that asked the democratic question, which is, who decides? Who is sovereign? They ask, is the economy for us, or do we exist for the economy? Do we exist for a few people to make a buck? And they said, well, I think that the economy exists for us, so we're going to pass some really basic laws to protect our right to govern what our economy looks like. And we're going to go through that quickly, and then we're going to dig into corporations getting personhood. Let's compare it to what happens now. Right now, does anybody know, do you know, or does anybody here know what it takes for you to start a corporation in Seattle? Okay. Okay, so you file, you write some bylaws, you apply, and you pay some money. In Utah, it's $50, I think.
$71.
$71, not a lot of money.
For an LCC.
So you do that, and bam, you have a corporation. Congratulations, you have a corporation. And how long can your corporation live? Amen. So yeah, you can exist forever. Let's compare that to the first 75 years of this country. If you wanted to incorporate in the first 75 years of this country, what did you have to do? Anyone? By raise of hand? All right, I'm going to repeat that by folding it into this sentence. How about that? You had to go to the state legislature and have them write a law saying that you could exist. And in order for them to do that, you had to prove one thing to them, and that is that you served the public good. Take a second, think about it. Picture your least favorite transnational corporation. How many of them could even get past the gate if that was the only requirement about what they did? That's pretty powerful. People from the beginning, from jump, said, corporations exist for us. We're going to make sure they do. That's one way we do it. Isaiah's corporation can exist forever. Back in the first 75 years of the country, how long could a corporation exist? 30 years?
Until
it fulfilled its purpose. What? Until your job's done? Okay, so those are all accurate answers. Corporate charters lasted from 3 to 50 years, or until the corporation's job that it applied to do was over. How powerful is that? 3 to 7 years, that was bank charters. People didn't like banks very much. So weird. And so people said banks last 3 to 7 years. Imagine if Goldman Sachs came to us, the American people, after the financial crash with their begging bowl and said, please, sir, could we have another charter? Would you give it to them?
Yes.
Would you say, ya basta, get out? I would say get out. So people had held corporations accountable. Every few years, corporations had to prove that they were serving the public good and doing their job. Let's keep going. So your corporation, what kind of work can you do? What kinds of things can you sell? Products. That's a good answer. Anything, right? Anything. In the first 75 years of the country, you were incorporated to do one task, like build a bridge or a road or a canal. And when that was over, your corporation went back into public hands. Nowadays, you can make however much money you're able to make. And back in the first 75 years of this country, you could make a certain amount, and your corporation became public because it belonged to the people, because the people helped to fund it. So all these laws, it went on and on. Shareholders had to be local. They had to live with the consequences of their decisions. There were no mergers. Books had to be open so people could read what the corporation was up to. And maybe most importantly for our purposes tonight, until 1850 on the books of many states, it was a felony for corporations to contribute a single penny in elections. A felony. It's a pretty serious crime. People who had lived through the revolution saw so clearly how quickly economic and political elite interests combined that they said, we're not going to let that happen on our watch. We're going to make it a felony for economic elites to give their money to political elites because that means tyranny for regular people. So that's pretty powerful. We talked about how power was constructed. This is how people, regular people, constructed their power to serve them instead of moneyed interests. So how does that make people feel in this crowd, hearing that story? Huh?
Jealous.
I heard jealous, hopeful, good. Okay, we don't have to do it exactly the same. Maybe we would do it differently. But the point is that there was a time in our country's history where people exercised real structural sovereignty over what their economy looked like and also what their political system looked like. And we can do that again. It's not impossible. There's a joke that corporate historian Jane Ann Morris tells that says, don't know if the mine in your backyard is bad for you? Hire an expert to prove that it isn't. So right now we live in the regulatory state where we think we have to be an expert to know if a copper mine, for example, is bad for our health. We don't need to be an expert. We have our experiences. We know that the smog we're breathing is bad for our lungs. We know that the dead fish in the water are trying to say something to us, right? We know our own experience, and we should be able to legislate from a basic sense of reality, not from a marble hall or because we've read every single right book, right? And that was what people said back then. We're experts of our own experience. We should have a say in our democracy and in our economy, and we say that we're in charge. The democratic answer. Who's in charge? We are. And so that was pretty powerful. So what happened? That's the story we're going to tell to each other for the rest of the night. And what happened is power always wants more power. Corporations didn't like having people have power over them. So they got together and they said, oh, feeling so claustrophobic in this democracy. What can we do? And they went to the legislators and they said, hey, why don't you lessen those restrictions? And the legislator said, yeah, there's still a good old boys club going on, but you don't pay for my election, so why should I listen to you? And they shooed them out of the building. So corporations thought, what can we do to get more power, to lessen these restrictions and to control the economy and the political system? And while they were thinking about it, something that was very good for corporations happened, a little old something called the Civil War. Can someone tell me why war is good for corporations? Munitions. Okay, yeah, replacing materials, labor, goods. So during the Civil War, a few corporations got incredibly powerful. Banking corporations, because the war had to be financed, and railroad and ammunition corporations, because the goods had to be transported. And when the war was over, everybody had been busy looking over here, and all this dastardly stuff was happening over here. The war ends, they look back, and they say, what were we thinking? One of those people was Abraham Lincoln, and he wrote a letter to his friend, and he said, and I'll convert it into teen talk, he basically said, you know how worried I was about the fate of the Union? Well, that's nothing compared to how worried I am now about the power of giant corporations and their ability to basically tear us under this democracy. That's Abraham Lincoln. He let it happen on his watch. He had no reason to call himself out like that, and he had every good reason in the world to be worried, because these corporations used the power that they got in war to go back to the legislatures and say, hey, how about lessening those restrictions? But still, the legislators were pretty slow. They weren't really doing what the corporations wanted, so the corporations said, okay, we have to take this more seriously. We have to go to the next level. We need to go to the least accountable, least democratic, and frankly, most boring, no offense to the lawyers out there, branch of government in the federal, in the, you know, triumvirate of the federal government. What branch is that? The judicial, right? Not many people are glued to court TV saying, what is going to happen to that tax fence case? I'm just up at night. I'm so stressed, right? So they said it's going to be a lot easier to convince 9 unelected judges that we are people than it is to convince millions of Americans that we are. So we're going to take our issue to the courts. And they said, what are we going to argue in the courts? And then they remember how great it is to be a legal person in a democracy. Because legal people get rights. So if we, with all of our power and our might and our control that we already have, we're also people, we could use our rights as a trump card over regular living, breathing people whenever they got too powerful for us to control in other ways. That sounds awesome. And so that is exactly what they did. They went to the Supreme Court and they argued that they were people. And we're going to tell that story together right now and figure out what happened. So what I have here is a timeline of corporate rights, the rights that corporations got through the Supreme Court, through the law. And I need about 15 volunteers to take one of these cards, and then you're going to read these out loud for people so we can learn from each other about how corporations got the rights that only human beings should have and what rights they got. So who can volunteer for me? All right. Come on up if you want to volunteer, and I'll just hand these to you.
Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, 1886. Without any formal argument, the court declares a corporation a person with the same rights as human beings. They grant them the 14th Amendment right to equal protection that was supposed to protect the recently emancipated black folks. Justices have since struck down hundreds of local, state, and federal laws enacted to protect people from corporation harm because these discriminate against corporations.
Okay, so can you tell us what you read? I mean, your own words, just maybe one thing that you read.
That they misinterpreted what was basically the outcome of the Civil War to give the people who were slaves the same status as everybody else that were voting, and they gave that to corporations.
So that's really important. The corporations used a specific amendment to argue that they were people under the law. Did you hear which one it was? 14th. The 14th protects people from discrimination. And it was the result of years of struggle on the part of one group that didn't count during the writing of the Constitution, African Americans who had been enslaved, who had formed a social movement with their white allies to drive themselves into the Constitution. They got into the Constitution, they forced an amendment through, and corporations used that amendment. How cynical can you get? That amendment to say, oh no, this amendment wasn't supposed to apply to these vulnerable, formerly disenfranchised people. It's supposed to apply to us. And the other thing that's interesting is that it was never argued. Did people hear that? That it was never argued in front of a court? Corporations came up, you know, or corporate executives came to the court and they said, they used these really boring cases. If you ever want to sleep at night, read through these cases. And they said, okay, so don't tax these fences. Do tax these fences. Also, I'm a person under the law. And they'd done this a few times without any success. And in 1886, they were about to make the same argument, and one judge on the court said, today I don't want to hear about whether corporations are people or not. Indeed, we are all of the opinion that they are. I don't know who he thought everyone was. He wasn't talking about the masses of American people who had no idea that this was going on, or the Congress, where this should have been decided. He said that, and I heard it back here, a court reporter wrote it down. The court reporter was a railroad man himself, wrote it down into the head notes of the case. It was never formally argued, and bam, that is how corporations became people under the law. It was never decided by the actual court. It shouldn't have been in the Supreme Court in the first place, and corporations pounced on that and started using that as precedent to say that they had 14th Amendment rights against discrimination. But what does that mean? First of all, boo hiss, right? Boo hiss. What does that mean? Because it's a wonky phrase, right? History's in the wonky phrases. One thing that it means is if a coal corporation, for example, wanted to move into your town, have you ever wondered why you can go to endless meetings about how high the smokestacks could be or how much they can poison you and maybe poison you a little bit less, but you can't just say what is your basic right in a democracy to say, which is no, I don't want the coal corporation in my town. Why should I have to? The one reason for that is if you said that, the coal corporation could come back and sue the city and say that you were discriminating against it the same way that you would be discriminating if you said, oh, I don't want a gay person living in my condo, in my housing association. So they use discrimination that's supposed to protect regular people to protect themselves at the expense of regular people. So we can't say simple things like yes and no because that violates the rights of the corporation. All right, so next one.
Hale versus Henkel, 1906. Corporations get Fourth Amendment search and seizure protections. Corporations use this right to demand that regulators get warrants before they can inspect businesses for violations of labor and environmental laws.
So what happened? What did they get? What right?
I don't know how else to put it, right? Protection against search and seizure. So it's an expansion of that personhood concept, because that's the concept that applies to individuals.
So corporations got Fourth Amendment rights against search and seizure. What does that mean? One thing it means is 14th Amendment means we can't pass robust laws that say yes or no. But the laws we are allowed to pass, these alphabet soup regulatory kind of regulations, when we go to enforce them, we send an inspector in to say, how are you treating your workers? Or are you dumping toxic sludge in the river? The corporate executive can say, oh, no, the corporation is a person. You can't come in here and inspect to see whether or not I'm following the law, because that's a violation of my Fourth Amendment search and seizure protections. So we can't even enforce the laws that we do pass. So that's pretty critical. All right, next.
The year is 1919, and the case is Dodge versus Ford Motor Company. Michigan Supreme Court rules that a corporation exists to maximize the profits of its shareholders, regardless of the impacts on the planet, the economy, or health and safety. This ruling mandates perpetual growth and practically guarantees human and environmental abuses.
Okay, what did you read? What happened?
The Michigan Supreme Court affirms what everybody here already knows, that corporations don't exist to help the common good. Corporations exist for one purpose, and that's to make money.
So thank you for reading. So that is a critical moment. I often think instead of having a laugh track, we should have a wah track for when we hear this, a scream track, like, oh, no. Because what's your name?
Jonathan.
Jonathan just read is that it's not that corporations just make money, or even that they try really hard to make a profit at our expense. It is that they are legally required to maximize profit for shareholders. So what happens if you have to maximize profits? Can you pay your workers well?
No.
That gets in the way of profits. Can you protect the environment? No, it gets in the way of profits. So we have essentially created a Frankenstein that serves the interests of a few and has turned against all of the rest of us, right? And it's really terrifying because it takes it from the personal to the structural. Because, you know, the Dalai Lama himself could be in charge of Walmart, and he couldn't do anything differently than the current CEO is doing, right? Because he is required to make a profit. So this is basically the law about the corporate form. Profit at any cost.
Pennsylvania Coal Company versus Mahan, 1922. Corporations get Fifth Amendment protections against the government taking their property without compensation. They use this right to argue that any law that impacts their ability to make maximum profit is a taking, and they can sue to recoup all the profits that they were making and would have made if the law hadn't passed. So this says that now, you know, if I'm a corporation and I think an environmental law or a public safety law is going to impact my ability to make money, I'm going to sue you and get that sucker off the books.
That's right. Okay. And even more, not just sue you, but sue you for all the money that I was making and all the money I would have made. That is a lot of zeros at the end of that number, right? It's incredible. They've essentially said that a law takes their property and violates their Fifth Amendment rights so that they can get back all the money that they would have made if the law had not been passed. So that's huge, right? Because what kind of laws can you pass in your community if you think that the corporation is just going to turn around and sue you for everything you've got? It's a total chilling effect on democracy. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely dangerous. And it also has psychological effects. Law influences culture, and culture influences law. So when these laws pass, they not only give power to corporations, they also limit what we as political, as Americans, think that we have a right to. They limit the scope of what conversations we can have, so we have all the wrong conversations instead of the big conversations that we need to have to protect the planet and each other.
This is Lewis K. Leggett Company versus Lee, 1933. The people of Florida passed a law that levied higher taxes on chain stores than local businesses. The Supreme Court overturned it because it discriminated against chain stores and violated megacorporations' 14th Amendment rights to equal protection, because everyone gets equal protection because megacorporations are people. It just goes back to the same, that old, some of us are more equal than others kind of phrase.
Exactly. Okay, so 14th Amendment, back there, right? Your good buddy back there? He helped you get the 14th Amendment. If you were a corporate executive, we know you're not. And now you use it to say, oh, you want to grow a local economy because that is more beneficial for mom-and-pop businesses and for people who live in the community. Too bad. It violates megacorporations' 14th Amendment rights. But let's reverse that a little bit and say, how many taxes are these megacorporations paying these days? Some of them $0. $0. How many taxes are you paying? What? Subsidies, exactly. So they don't mind so much when the hypocrisy goes the other way. A very important point to remember. Go for it.
All right. We're up to 1976, Buckley versus Vallejo. The Supreme Court rules that corporations have First Amendment rights to freedom of speech. Since corporations do not have mouths to speak with, the court rules that they speak by spending money in elections. This opened the door to a glut of corporate spending in the political process. It's pretty clear. I'm surprised that was in my lifetime, actually. In 1976, you can spend money. Money equals speech. It's not one person, one vote. It's $1, one vote.
What we have down there with Alan is the start of a terrible metaphor. And we have the metaphor getting more and more tortured. And then it gets to, what's your name?
Court.
Court. Okay? And we have this idea. A corporation is a person. And the person of the corporation comes and says, I have all the Bill of Rights protections. And I want the First Amendment right to freedom of speech. Maybe the most sacrosanct and important right that you could have in a functioning democracy. They want that because they have power, money, control of the government, control of the media, lobbyists, cultural cred, and now they say, if we can speak on top of all that, well, we can just waste the competition. And so they said, we speak. And the court said, we would love to agree with you, but we have one problem, which is even we can't figure out a way that we can give you mouths. You don't have mouths. You're not a person. And the corporate lawyer said, oh, that's what we're here for. We speak by spending money. Money is our mouth. So right here, we have the end of democracy. I'm not being facetious. What we have definitionally is a change from one person, one vote to $1, one vote. What is that called? A plutocracy. Corpocracy, fascism. There are lots of words for that. Okay? So it completely perverts the idea that you and I have a say, because if money is speech, then what is poverty? Silence. Muteness. Right? Okay, so that's a huge problem. So we have the beginnings of, we have had plutocracy in different ways in our history, but we have the institutional legal beginnings of plutocracy right here by corporations spending money in elections. All right, next.
First National Bank of Boston versus Bellotti, 1977. Corporations use their First Amendment rights to overturn state restrictions on corporate spending on political referenda. Now corporations like Walmart can exponentially outspend organizers on citizens' initiatives that are designed to let everyday people make democratic decisions about their community. This interferes with the most direct form of electoral democracy we have. Well, corporations can outspend anybody. And so the people do not have any protection even in the courts, because you can't afford to keep going back to court like the corporations can.
Yes, that's it. So I've heard a lot about 522, right, the ballot initiative about GMOs. So you guys are organizing as everyday people to say we don't want poisons in our food. They should be labeled at very, very least. And the corporations can say, oh, you want a ballot initiative? That's cute. A ballot initiative meaning that everybody should be able to weigh in. Ballot initiatives brought to us by the populist movement as a form of direct democracy. They say, okay, well, good luck with that ballot initiative when I can dump hundreds of thousands of dollars into millions. Defeating it. Millions. Millions of dollars from people in Washington? Is the money, right, is the money from people in Washington? Five corporations, $11 million. They don't live here. They don't have to deal with the consequences. So that's what that law was saying. Go ahead.
Okay. 1986, Pacific Gas and Electric Company versus Public Utilities Commission. Although PG&E has a monopoly on utilities in California, they refused to allow an advocacy group to use extra space on their billing envelope to encourage energy conservation. The court sided with PG&E, upholding the corporation's right not to speak and protecting what they called the corporation's
freedom of mind.
It's always good to end on a joke.
I'm not sure how to say what that means, but I am getting an incredible depth into this issue that I didn't have when I arrived.
Well, that's great. So PG&E has a monopoly in California on electricity, and so they're essentially a government entity, but they're making a lot of money. And this conservation group says, hey, we think it's pretty risky that you're a corporation who's wanting to make money off of electricity usage, and we want to encourage people to conserve. So we should be able to put something in the envelope that says, hey, turn off your lights sometimes. Pretty small demand. And PG&E says, no, not, in addition to having the right to speak, I also have the right not to speak. And you putting that conservation advice in the newsletter that goes out to everybody in the state, that violates my freedom of mind. Freedom of mind. Let's just let that soak in while we go to the next one.
But wait, there's more. 1996, International Dairy Foods Association versus AMSTOY. Supreme Court overturns a Vermont law requiring the labeling of all products containing bovine growth hormone, citing the corporation's right not to speak if it would damage their reputation or profit. And this extends, the protection extends to statements of fact as well as statements of opinion? Really? Wow. So no matter what they say, truth, lie, doesn't matter, it's protected.
And so, you know, if somebody came in here and said, hey guys, I poisoned all the desserts. Just wanted you to know that. Sorry if you already ate any. And we said, wait a minute, that's terrible. Why didn't you tell us earlier? And they said, oh, I have a right not to speak. We would tell that person, oh, actually, the meeting of the Sociopaths Anonymous is down the hall. Thanks for coming. So, but what we ensconce this in our law and say that corporations can do this to all of us. We don't even have the right to know what to avoid because they have a right not to speak, fact or opinion. All right, next.
2010, Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. The Supreme Court reaffirms that a corporation is a person and states that any restrictions on corporate money in elections violates the corporation's First Amendment right to free speech. This ruling overturned most provisions of McCain-Feingold legislation that restricted corporate money in federal elections and reversed a 100-year precedent of congressional authority to regulate federal elections. Opens the floodgates to unlimited corporate spending in elections. $6 billion is spent in the 2012 election cycle. Unlimited money can be spent on elections because it's free speech.
So there's a boo hiss moment.
Boo.
All right, anybody catch that? So who here came in familiar with Citizens United? Who here thought that it was the first time that the Supreme Court gave corporations human rights? A lot of people do. But what happened before that? So this was the, you know, coup de grace for the Supreme Court, the last and most recent in a series of corporate coups over our democracy. So $6 billion. That's a lot of jelly beans in a jar. I don't need $6 billion to convince you to vote for clean air and a livable planet and well-paying jobs and justice. I need $6 billion if I want to convince you to vote exactly the opposite of the interest of all of your constituents. $6 billion. So let's keep that in mind. And next.
Notice of the right to unionize barred, 2013. Federal appeals court struck down a National Labor Relations Board rule requiring that corporations post a poster with information informing workers of their right to form or join a union, to strike, to bargain collectively, and to organize to improve working conditions. The court decided that the rule violated the free speech right of the corporation not to speak and that it punished a corporation for expressing its views, reaffirmed corporate rights at the expense of union rights. And strangely enough, this is not the first time, this is just the latest in a long series of corporations having a right not to speak when it would profit them not to speak.
That's right. So in that we have an example of when you go to work and you walk into your workplace and shut the door, you have fewer democratic rights than many people in what you would probably consider dictatorial regimes in other countries. And yet the corporation's rights are supreme. So Unions, as one of the big forces for equality and justice in our country, are basically flattened, and workers don't even get informed of their right to form one. So we have one. So that was a notice of right to unionize barred. There's not a specific name like this versus this. It was an NLRB ruling, a National Labor Relations Board ruling. Go ahead.
This is McCutcheon versus the FEC, 2013. A wealthy Republican donor has driven a case into the Supreme Court that seeks to overturn laws limiting campaign contributions from individuals. The case threatens to knock down one of the final barriers to legalize bribery, allowing wealthy candidates to give over $3 million to one candidate. The court will decide the case this fall.
All right. So that's, you know, part of the to-be-continued story. And that doesn't have to explicitly do with corporate personhood. It's about the bigger story we're talking about tonight, which is concentrated wealth in politics and the effect of inequality in the political system. So just out of curiosity, if you want to divulge, who here has $3 million to give to one candidate in the next election? If you do, talk to me. You can donate to Move to Amend instead. $3 million. You know, the Koch brothers spent over $300 million. If $1 equals one vote, that's these corporations or these wealthy individuals voting millions of times. What would you argue for if you had the capacity to talk to your congressperson millions of times? Probably something pretty different than what corporations are arguing for. So this is the story of corporate personhood. You can pass your things back to me. While we ask, why do we need to amend the Constitution to say that corporations are not people and money is not speech? And thanks to the volunteer readers. And so we've answered our first question. Why is Move to Amend amending the Constitution to say corporations are not people and money is not speech? We have a series of court cases that gave corporations First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, 14th Amendment rights that only human beings should have, and that said that they spent money as a form of speaking. We have to go over the Supreme Court's head and say the Supreme Court never should have decided these questions. They were wrong on the law, and we the people have to reclaim our power over our government so that we can start to make the laws, create the cultures and the structures that actually protect life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for flesh and blood beings rather than for corporations that exist to make a profit, right? But we also have a broader goal of building a democracy movement across issues that normally divide us or that often divide us. So we're going to do a sped up version of two final timelines that explore why Move to Amend is building a movement and why we're building a movement across these dividing lines. And so what happened to all these people back in the constitutional era that didn't count the first time? They didn't sit around, right? What did they do? They formed movements. So we're going to learn a little bit about movements. I need about 15 more volunteers to read through, get in order these cards. So come on up. So this is what people did, how people used law and culture to transform their realities.
Okay, Bill of Rights, 1791. Outraged revolutionaries reject the Constitution as an elite property document and refuse to ratify it unless it contains basic political protections against the tyranny of the state. Their struggle is successful, and they drive through 10 amendments to the Constitution that protect people's rights to freedom of speech, assembly, religion, and the press, as well as others.
Yay. 13th Amendment, 1865. Slavery is abolished in the U.S. and any place subject to its jurisdiction.
Yay. Civil Rights Act, 1866. Extended the rights of emancipated African Americans by stating that any person born in the United States, regardless of race, is a U.S. citizen.
14th Amendment, 1868. African Americans are declared citizens, entitled to equal protection of the laws, essentially banning discrimination.
15th Amendment, 1870, African American males earn the right to vote.
Yay!
Social change in 1886.
Oh, one comment about this. Social change in 1886. What's relevant about the year 1886?
That's that first law.
The first time a corporation got the rights of personhood, what was going on in the country?
The year that the Supreme Court first gave corporation rights, this is what the rest of the country was up to. Campaign for the 8-hour workday. Knights of Labor membership, 1 million, with 60,000 black and even more women members. Farmers Alliance reaches 100,000 members. Populists draw up founding document to demand debtors' rights and fight the railroad lobby. Eugene Debs builds the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen. Das Kapital by Karl Marx published in England, in English. Oops. Police brutalize labor activists in the Haymarket Massacre.
1913, 17th Amendment, U.S. Senate is now elected by the people instead of appointed by state governments.
19th Amendment, 1920, women finally get the vote after 75 years of the struggle.
Jumping up to 1954, Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, the Supreme Court recognized that separate was not equal and ruled that public schools cannot be racially segregated.
The 24th Amendment, 1964, abolished poll taxes, which were used to keep blacks and others from voting in some states.
Civil Rights Acts, 1960, established federal inspection of local voter registration polls. 1964, prohibits discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin by federal and state governments. 1968, prohibits discrimination in sale, rental, and financing of housing based on race, creed, or national origin. Woo!
1971, 26th Amendment, voting age changed from 21 to 18 years of age, passed to recognize that if 18-year-olds could be drafted into military service, they should be allowed to vote.
Roe v. Wade, 1973. The Supreme Court rules that state statutes against abortion are vague and infringe on a woman's 9th and 14th Amendment rights to privacy. Abortion is legalized in the first trimester of pregnancy.
Yay. Okay, so let's hear a yay for all of the social movement leaders. Just pass that back to me. Thank you for reading. So how do you all feel after hearing that?
Better.
So, since we have a limited time, I'm just going to ask a couple of questions. Did people in power decide one day that African Americans should be emancipated from slavery, women should have the right to vote and not be considered property, and that people of all colors should be protected from discrimination wherever they were?
No.
What happened? Does law happen in a vacuum?
No.
What was happening?
Social movement.
Check out 1886. Pretty exciting year to be alive. Pretty depressing year to be alive if you're a corporation until you get the rights of personhood. It was not an accident that corporations went to the courts to get personhood the same year that people were fomenting all different kinds of structural revolutionary movements around the country. They protected their rights in law because that was their trump card over movements created by people like you and me. So are a bunch of people in suits going to decide in a corporate-occupied Congress that corporations should no longer have the rights of human beings? What is it going to take?
Us.
How many of us?
All
of us. Lots of us. And a huge, robust movement that are making our demands from our stomachs and our hearts and our brains all at the same time, saying who we are and what we want from the beginning. One more question. Are these movements done? Are women equal? Are black people equal? to solve everything? Of course not, right? So a law is only as good as the people who are enforcing it. And I'm not talking about police officers. I'm talking about you and me. A law is only as powerful as the movement behind it. People in power will always try to gut, manipulate, or distort laws for their benefit. So we have to have a powerful movement to protect the laws that we do pass. It's also called a movement because it doesn't end. It's a struggle. It's a movement. We keep moving. And so at Move to Amend, we want to add ourselves onto this beautiful history of people who said no to injustice and yes to equality. One final question about movements. Was the goal of the women's suffrage movement the right to vote? Was that its end goal?
No.
Would the right to vote fix hundreds of years of being treated as property and being under misogynist cultures and societies?
No.
So what was the goal of the women's movement?
Change in consciousness,
change in culture. What else? Equality. A voice, justice. Okay, same with the abolitionist movement. Was the goal just the elimination of slavery? For some people, it was. And as it went on, they said, that's not enough. And it morphed into the civil rights movement and all these other movements for black power, people of color power. And the goal is, once again, justice and equality, right? So is the goal of the Move to Amend movement just to amend the Constitution? What is our goal?
Justice.
Our amendment is a way to talk about equality and justice with millions of people across the country. So we're going to do one final short timeline, or it's not short, but we'll do it quickly before we go, which is, why do we need to build a democracy movement across race, class, and gender? Why can't we just go to our friends at the country club? I don't have any, but if you do, why can't we go to them and just say, hey, can you get this passed? Why do we need to actually form a movement that addresses and heals the wounds and the consequences of a corporate culture that has created an exacerbated race? In other words, how have elites used the law and the culture to construct differences between us, to make it harder for us to work together? So we're going to do one last timeline, and then we're going to close. So I'm going to need about 15 more people to come and read. It's okay if you've already read before. And I'm going to say that this is a timeline about the way that people, elites, used law and culture to create identities and to ensconce their power over others. This is a hard timeline. And I want to say that if you're reading or if you're in the audience and you need to leave, you can. And I also want to recognize that for many people in the world, we carry this history on our skin and in our bodies, and it's very real. So to read it with respect, the respect that it deserves. So we'll just read it without commenting, and then we'll wrap up.
An Act for Preventing Negro Insurrection, Act 10. 1680. It was too close. Blacks are banned from carrying weapons of any kind, and if they presume to physically resist any Christian, they are punished with 30 lashes on his bare back, well laid on. Blacks could also be legally murdered if they are found lurking in obscure places, avoiding labor.
Slave and Servant Codes, 1680 to 1705. Established the term slave as equivalent to Negro, while servant now refers only to non-blacks or white persons. Slaves can be accidentally killed by their masters without penalty and are slaves for life along with all their children. In contrast, servants are granted new protections and privileges, including the right to take their masters to court, the right to marry another European immigrant, and the guarantee of a severance pay and a plot of land when freed from service. Black-white marriage is banned and interracial sex is fined.
1830, Indian Removal Act. Indigenous peoples are forced from their homelands east of the Mississippi River. Over 10 years, approximately 100,000 native children and adults marched thousands of miles west into unknown desert territory. 15,000 people died along the way.
The Cherokee Nation versus the State of Georgia, 1831. A Cherokee delegation sues the state of Georgia for stripping their people of land and rights. But the court rules they are a domestic dependent nation, unable to claim status in court, validating Cherokee removal and state seizure of their land.
Dred Scott versus Sanford, 1857. A slave sues his owner for freedom in a state where slavery is banned. The U.S. Supreme Court rules that Negroes are not U.S. citizens under any circumstances and have no rights which any white man is bound to respect. Free blacks are taxed like whites, but receive none of the rights and protections of citizenship.
The Homestead Act of 1862, 50 million acres of formerly indigenous land in the West, seized by U.S. invasion in violation of treaties, is distributed by the government at low cost to white settlers only. An additional 100 million acres of land are given for free to railroad developers.
Minor versus Happersett, 1874. Women argued that the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause ensured their right to vote. The Supreme Court rejected their claims, stating that the 14th Amendment only applied to black males. Then gave corporations 14th Amendment rights just 12 years later.
Chinese Exclusion Act, 1882, bans immigration of both skilled and unskilled Chinese laborers. This act is expanded in 1924 to restrict other Asian immigrants and ban Chinese white marriages in California.
You have to excuse me. I'm Cherokee Choctaw Apache, and that is just so hard to hear. 1924, Johnson-Reed Act creates immigration quota system based on national origin, favoring Nordics from Northern and Western Europe over the inferior races of Asia and Southern and Eastern Europe.
National Housing Act, 1934. Following the Great Depression, a federal housing authority is created to provide loans for home ownership, but the FHA standards discriminate against non-whites and deter investment in non-white communities. Known as redlining, this practice boosts the economic value of white neighborhoods relative to non-white neighborhoods.
Social Security Act, 1935. This act provides old-age insurance for the mostly white workforce of certain industries, excluding domestic and agricultural workers who are mostly non-white.
Japanese American internment, 1942, forces all Japanese American and Japanese residents living on the west coast of the U.S. into unsanitary, fenced concentration camps called war relocation camps. Over 111,000 people are interned, 62% of them American citizens.
GI Bill, 1944. The Servicemen's Readjustment Act offers education and housing subsidies to returning war veterans, but severe social discrimination, poverty, and lack of education prevents black veterans from receiving these benefits, while white veterans benefit disproportionately.
War on Drugs, 1971. President Richard Nixon declares a war on drugs, disproportionately and violently targets economically impoverished communities of color for the next 40 years, leading to mass incarceration for drug-related offenses. White populations are relatively unaffected.
NYPD Stop and Frisk, 2011. In 2011, New York City's discriminatory Stop and Frisk program continues to escalate, with over 680,000 public police stops made on the street and 84% of those stops being blacks or Latinos. Justified as a gun control measure, less than 0.2% of stops turn up guns, while 88% of stops result in no charges at all.
So why why do we need to build a multiracial movement across class and across gender lines? For justice. Because none of us are immune, and because many of us have been disproportionately harmed and wounded by the system for hundreds of years. So for me, the question is, what is it going to be? There is never a time in our country's history that was democratic for the majority of people. There's nothing, no age of original innocence to go back to. There was always the struggle between the people with money and power and the people who wore the harms of that money and power on their bodies and in their lives, and who formed movements to say that they had dignity and the state had to recognize it. And so for us, the question is the same. What is it going to be? Moneyed interests control our lives in the form of powerful corporations that have taken over our government. We wear those wounds on our bodies, and people of color communities and poor communities and women and disenfranchised people wear those wounds disproportionately. If we are going to win the amendment, we have to have all of these people. If we are going to win justice, we have to listen to these people and to listen to each other tell the stories of how corporations and money and power has harmed us over time. And we have to build a movement that is so powerful and so filled with those stories that we can't be stopped. And that's why I'm part of Move to Amend, because the constitutional amendment is part of a broader question about what it would look like for 95% of the people who didn't count the first time to have a real and actual say in something that was actually a democracy. And I think that one of the most important cards on that timeline is the Slave and Servant Code card, where they created a term for white people and a term, or the servant for white people and slave for black people. They did that to divide us so that we would spend, the people with a little bit more power would spend all of our time fighting the people with a little bit less, so that we'd never look at the top of the pyramid and see who was controlling it all. So it's time for us to come together and look at the top of the pyramid, name that problem, name it as unjust, and do something about it. So I hope that you join with Move to Amend, and I hope you join with WAMEND to actually start feeling your own power again, and to be serious about that power and what it means, and to believe that you can form power collectively to eliminate and to undo even the grossest injustices, remembering that the women's suffrage movement went into a male-exclusive Congress saying that they were people, human beings, that had to be recognized by law. And they fought and they fought and they fought, and I'm here today as a beneficiary of that fight. The fact that I can do certain things and say certain things and think certain things is a result of their struggle. And so I hope, that timeline always makes me very emotional, and this idea makes me emotional. And so we know that we live in a world that is completely dominated by corporations and corporate interests, and we are going into a corporate-occupied Congress, and we are saying we demand an amendment. We are not asking, we're demanding. We're demanding justice, and we're going to do it together. And please join the movement. And please add your experience and your story and your power and your voice to the movement. And please join WAMEND in their effort to collect over 300,000 signatures to get on the ballot. It is possible, and it is scary at first to talk to somebody about how you feel, but once you start doing it, my experience is that it's incredibly liberating, because people don't want us to feel our own power. People in power don't want us to feel our power, because it's pretty intoxicating, and you want to keep talking, and you want to keep organizing, and you want to keep coming together. So thank you.